Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, you spin me right round, baby, right round. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Volkbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
So, guys, have you ever needed to, you know, have a nice, quiet, secure communication with someone or something?
Yeah, I might need to have a secure communication. Let's say if I'm dealing with an internet seller. So maybe a seller on Etsy who has created glass, handcrafted Star Wars action figures with stain-tinted coloring. And
it's oddly specific.
That sounds precarious but beautiful.
Yeah. It's also not what I thought you were going to say, because internet seller, I thought you were either talking about someone who sells internets, or perhaps a dark...
The basement of the internet
dark,
where they keep the internet
room.
Wine.
Exactly. But now I've got you. All right, so a vendor, a merchant on the internet, and you want to make a transaction, you obviously...
Say, here are all my special numbers.
Right, you would want those special numbers to
remain
special.
Send me glass Han Solo.
Yeah, but you would not want those special numbers to get out and about to the general public where they could all make their own nefarious purchases using your hard-earned money.
Right, they could go buy their own glass memorabilia or...
Or let's say that you are just trying to send a message to someone and you don't necessarily want the entire world to understand what exactly you are saying.
Sure.
You know?
Right.
These are things, right?
Right. Like if I wanted to send Lauren an email talking smack about a certain other host of this show, and I didn't want that host to be privy to all the things I had to say about him.
Sure.
Yeah. And of course, no one believes this because you just talked smack, right? Out loud in
right
the
across
office.
The table.
So,
yeah.
Right,
but all
right,
that's. But hypothetically, if you didn't want me to know, I'm sorry, you didn't want this other host to know, then this would be important. You would want to be able to hide the information. Thus,
sure.
This is, of course, not new to the internet. You know, the idea of being able to hide information so that you can send messages discreetly, secretly. This is not something that's brand new. This is an ancient idea.
Oh, no, of course. I mean, secrets are power. It's one of the main things we've got going for us as a species. We've learned how to leverage privileged information.
Yes.
You know something they don't know, and that gives you an advantage.
Right. You know, obviously, if you are able to maintain that advantage, then that gives you well, prolonged advantage. You don't want that to suddenly become common knowledge because then suddenly it's a level playing field again. And who knows, some bigger, stronger person's going to come around and take all your stuff. So in the ancient world, we use things called ciphers, which mm-hmm. allowed us to jumble up a message so that only the person who sends it and the person who receives it ideally have any chance of figuring out what that message is. Now, that just might mean that you have an agreed-upon set of rules, which means when you get a message, you look at the message, the jumbled-up message, and you apply those set of rules to it to unscramble it and see what the actual message is.
Right. So the dirt simplest version of this would be just say like an alphanumeric scramble. So you say A is 1 and B is 2, mm-hmm. and you you translate your message in whatever language you're writing into numbers.
Right. The same kind of thing that you probably did to obscure notes when you were passing them in class when you were in like elementary school.
Right. An A is a B and a B is a C. No one's ever going to figure it out. Yeah. These are all very common, very simple ciphers. Now, in the world of the internet, in the world of computers, these sort of things don't fly.
No, that's not going to work anymore because it's pretty easy to figure that one out.
So we're talking about specifically cryptography in general, which is the whole science of making stuff secret. And then encryption in particular, which is an implementation of cryptography. And the reason why I say that is that frequently people will interchange these two terms, but they do mean different things.
We'll probably do it on this podcast.
Yeah.
Everybody uses encryption, cryptography, cryptology, that they'll get jumbled up.
Right. And I admit, I mean, I do this all the time. It's not because I don't appreciate that there are differences. It's just that my brain starts taking shortcuts and then I get less accurate in my description. But yes, cryptography, the overall field, encryption, a specific implementation of cryptography where you are encrypting a message using some sort of cipher or key, and then someone else has to use a decoder key to get at the original message. And if everything is cool, then you don't have to worry about anyone else intercepting that message and knowing what's going on.
But the problem is, things aren't really cool in the real world, are they?
Not 100% cool.
When you send a message to somebody, it's generally, I think, assumed within the world of cryptography that you should always just take as an assumption that somebody's listening.
Yes. I mean, we're living in a world now where it is incredibly easy for people to listen in, whether on purpose or not. I mean, I remember this applies to lots of different fields, not just internet communication.
Yeah, it could be a telephone.
Right. I remember using wireless telephones where occasionally it would pick up conversations other people were having that because the channels were close enough where I was getting interference. And I was thinking,
and so eventually one part of one of the conversations would kind of go like, hello?
Right.
Is that, are right. we, who else is here?
Or I would talk into it and then it would be clear that the other parties on the line couldn't hear me. But yet I was like, well, I don't want to listen in, but I would like to make a phone call. So I'm going to go and use one of the hard-lined phones that I have instead of one of these super cheap early 80s wireless monstrosities.
Of course, your hardline phone can be tapped just as easily.
Oh, sure, sure.
Or someone in another branch of the house could pick up another receiver of it.
Right. So in this case, we are going to be talking about some famous people. Those famous people are not really people. They're actually, their names are placeholders for any two entities that wish to exchange information. This would be Alice and Bob. You may have heard of Alice and Bob. Alice and Bob, they're, like I said, placeholders. It's so that you can give examples so people can wrap their heads around the way this kind of secret communication works.
So it's not Alice in Wonderland and Bob Seger.
I mean, it could be. We might, sure.
But we're talking about a third person as well. We're talking also about Eve.
Yes, Eve would be short for eavesdropper.
Mm.
Ah, clever, huh?
See what they did there. Yeah.
Eve wants to listen in on this conversation between Alice and Bob for whatever reason. Doesn't matter. We're just talking about, you know, again, concepts here. Eve also does not necessarily have to be an actual conscious person or entity.
No, Eve could be a computer.
Eve could also just be an environment. Because in this case, when we get into later in the podcast, we're going to be talking about a type of cryptography that has some limitations around it. And the environment can actually play a role in messing up that cryptography. But in general, we think of Eve as some entity trying to intercept messages, usually in the middle between Alice and Bob, to try and decipher exactly what is going on.
Okay, so in the world today, if Alice and Bob want to have a totally private conversation that nobody else can know about over the internet, what is the main way we're going to use to communicate privately?
That would be using key encryption, a public key and a private key. This is based off something called RSA encryption. It's actually named after the folks who came up with it. But the idea here is that you have a public key that allows people to encode messages that are going to be sent to you, and then you have a private key that allows you to decode those messages. And then if you want to send a message back to someone, you use their public key to encode it, and they'll use their own private key to decode it. So the public key is something you can send out to the world, and it's fine, because all it does is encode messages. It doesn't decode anything. And the private key you keep to yourself, and you don't let anyone get hold of it, because obviously that would mean they could decode any message meant for you. So in this case, if Alice wanted to send Bob a message, Alice would use Bob's public key. Bob would use his private key to decode it. Then if Bob wanted to respond, he would use Alice's public key. Alice would use her private key to decode it. Theoretically, everything should remain safe.
Okay, but wait a second. How do these keys actually work together? Because I wonder if there's a way to exploit this process.
It's interesting that you asked that question. So there are different ways to create encryption keys, but one of the most popular is prime factorization.
Tell me how it works.
Okay, you know what a prime number is, right?
It's a number that is only divisible by itself and one.
That is correct. So if you were to take a two prime numbers, so figure out two prime numbers.
3 and 7.
All right. And then you multiply the two of those together, you get?
21.
All right. So if I gave you just the 21, and I told you it's your job to figure out which two prime numbers I use to multiply together to get to 21, you would have to start going through and looking at the divisors for 21 and figuring it out. Now, that one's pretty easy.
Oh, right. But when you get into very large numbers, there's a lot of different possibilities.
Yeah.
Yeah, it might be worth dwelling for a minute on why that's hard to do. There's no just simple equation for how to get those prime numbers. You have to try them one at a time.
Right.
So you have to take, okay, is 2 times 2, that's not 21. Okay, 2 times 3, that's not 21.
Really, you would just say 21. Is 21 divisible by 2? And if so, is the other number also a prime? So you could do it that way. So you take 21 and you say, all right, let's go 21 divided by 2. All right, that doesn't work. 21 divided by 3, that gets me a 7. Wait a minute, 3 and 7 are both prime numbers.
Oh, okay, so that'd be pretty easy. But...
yeah, but if you're talking about enormous prime numbers, and when I say enormous, I'm talking about something that has maybe, 40 digits or more behind it. You know, that's a huge prime number huge prime number, and you multiply it by another huge prime number that has an equal number of digits behind it. You get an incredibly enormous product, and this is the basis of your encryption. Then working backwards, trying to figure out which two prime numbers made that product is incredibly difficult. It would take a classical computer working on a single core processor years, maybe centuries, to figure it out.
I've heard it often expressed that it would take more than a person's lifetime,
yes,
to solve these on a classical machine.
Yeah. So the three guys who came up with this, their last names were Rivest, or still are, Rivest, Shamir, and Edelman. So you've got,
hence
that's
the
RSA. And they were the ones who came up with this general idea, which has been used extensively since then. And basically, that's the idea you use. You've got this product which you can then allow people to encode things using this. It's kind of like another mashup type deal. The coded message gets sent to you because you have the actual prime numbers that were used to make that product. You can decode the message. If you don't have those two prime numbers, you can't decode it. So that's the general idea. And because it's such a hard problem that computers normally would take a very long time to solve, it was considered extremely secure.
Well, but is it still extremely secure? If it's so difficult to crack, then how is it vulnerable?
It depends on the determination and resources of your Eve.
That's exactly right. So the reason it's secure is because of the limitations of computers.
Right.
But if you were just to say, imagine you had a computer that was way, 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 way more powerful than your standard computer today, this problem would start becoming a lot less of a problem. And in fact, we can sort of create these situations today by, say, teaming up a lot of computers together.
Right. If you either had a supercomputer that had lots and lots of processing cores, and you created a program to look for the prime, factorization of any number, and you allowed it so that it could take advantage of all those processor cores and start solving things in parallel, you cut down on the amount of time it's going to take to do the overall problem because you've got multiple cores all working on this. Or if you are able to link together a bunch of computers to essentially do the same thing where each computer is working on part of this problem. Let's say that a computer just has a chunk of numbers that it's looking at as it goes through the possibilities.
I'll take the first 1,000 prime numbers, and Joe across the network, you take the next 1,000,
right,
et cetera.
Yeah, and you've got maybe hundreds of computers in this network. This is something that someone with a zombie army, a botnet, could do. They've infected a bunch of computers. They're using their processors to do whatever. One of those things could be to try and do a brute force attack. That's what we call it because you're using just brute computing force to go through all the potential possibilities to try and find the actual two numbers that were used to multiply together and make that product.
Yeah, you're just doing trillions and trillions of calculations spread out. But even with this approach, RSA is still pretty secure. Well, yeah. Just because of the scale of the math involved, the kinds of computers we have today, even if we imagine these brute force scenarios, it's still pretty secure.
It is pretty secure. If you've got someone who's really, really determined, and they're using an advanced computer, especially one that is able to take advantage of graphics processors, which, you know, graphics processors are meant to process graphics on your computer. But a lot of hackers have been using it as a way of creating another avenue for brute force attacks. Mm-hmm. It's something that is possible to crack. It's not easy to do, and it still is going to take time, depending upon, you know, how resourceful that hacker is, how many machines they might have at their disposal. But it's one of those things where, you know, the larger your numbers that you're using in your encryption, the more time is required or the more processing power is required to break that encryption, and the less likely it's going to happen because the number of people who have that capability and that desire starts to shrink. Mm-hmm. You know, the more complex it gets, the fewer people are going to say, yeah, that's worth my time.
Sure, but okay, so we're living in the incredible future, right?
And okay, sure.
We are starting to develop, at any rate, computers that are different from the classical computers that we have been talking about.
Uh-huh.
We've talked on this very show before, in fact, about quantum computers.
Damn you, quantum computers!
So, you know, when we talked about quantum computers, one of the things we discussed is how they might not really even provide an advantage if you're just talking about wanting to stream video and send emails and browse the web. So why on earth would somebody want to build a quantum computer if it doesn't provide an advantage at those things?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily going to help your Twitch skills at Call of Duty, but what it could do is allow you to solve certain types of problems much more quickly than you would with a classical computer. Because
like these problems specifically.
Exactly.
Yeah. Because
you've got qubits.
Qubits.
Yeah.
As opposed to bits.
Right. So a bit is a bit of data. It's a zero or a one. It's kind of like an on or off switch, or an off and on switch if you're talking zero and one. Qubits are quantum bits. And one of the properties of the quantum world is called superposition, where you can have a quantum particle that can inhabit multiple states simultaneously. So, for example, we talk about photons and their spin, and we'll talk about them more in a minute. But a photon can have various types of spin, vertical, horizontal, diagonal. In the quantum state, it can have all of these simultaneously in superposition. So a qubit can be both a zero and a one at the same time, and technically all values in between. So if you have qubits and you have enough of them, like you have a quantum computer that has a lot of qubits, you can then solve certain really difficult problems like prime factorization all in parallel, because it's essentially, this is oversimplifying, but it's essentially doing all the calculations simultaneously. So at any rate, if you've got a quantum computer that has a significant enough number of qubits, then in theory, you could break this kind of prime factorization problem in no time.
Okay, but I mean, quantum computers, although they do exist,
yeah.
I mean, who has the time or the money or the resources or the desire to possibly own such a fascinating and rare piece of machinery who also wants to know all of our secrets?
We've now entered into the Jonathan, Lauren, and Joe get on some more government lists part of the podcast. The NSA.
Yeah, so it turns out among the many things we learned from the leaked documents that Edward Snowden provided about the NSA, one of the things was we discovered a $79.7 million research project known as Penetrating Hard Targets of the NSA, and it was very interested in building, quote, a cryptologically useful quantum computer. So I hope you like your email with the side of spying, because this is on the way. The NSA has specifically expressed interest in creating quantum computers that can do that brute force mathematical attack to decode your encrypted messages.
Right. It's essentially going to sit there and make private keys, the private public key encryption technique that we've really been reliant upon for more than a couple of decades now, completely useless. It'll essentially be one of those things that if they direct their attention to you, they will be able to break that key and read everything that's coming to you.
Right. And so part of the problem is because all of this research is classified, we don't know how far along they are on this path. I mean, you might think that they're ahead of where the private labs are today, or you might think they're running neck and neck with them. We don't really know, but we at least know that they are really interested in this and are willing to spend money on it.
Okay, but part of the game here, you know, you're always going to have people who are trying to keep something secret and people who are trying to figure those secrets out.
Yep.
And as the technology of one increases, the other has to in order to compete.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, there are people who are working on creating quantum cryptography to help solve this entire problem for us.
Right, yeah. So we go to another quantum technology, basically, to offset that. So the secret breakers are going to get a big advantage with quantum computers.
But only because we are using classical computers to set up our original encryption. If we move to
A quantum system of being able to hide what we're saying. Actually,
right.
This is
it's a quantum framework. You can still use classical computers to do the communication.
Yeah, you need a quantum emitter is what you're going to need. I can actually explain what we're talking about here with quantum cryptography, at least on a high level. When you get down to it, you start getting into quantum weirdness that I know happens, but that's different from saying, I understand it.
Right. Okay, so I have a pretty good way, I think, of getting into how quantum cryptography works. And so it's this question.
Okay.
Why even use a public key in the first place? Why can't you just share a private key between Alice and Bob? So they've got a private decoder algorithm known only to them. And then they just use that. Why even put half of that key out there for people to use in a brute force attack? Well, the answer is kind of obvious because in order to do that, they'd have to share the private key over the internet.
If someone's eavesdropping like Eve and Eve intercepts the private key, then you've just given Eve the magic decoder ring to decode all the messages.
Right. So ideally, the best case scenario would be that Alice and Bob have a private key known only to them, but that really only works in the real world if they share it somehow physically in the same location.
Right.
If they go up to each other and whisper it to one another in a completely darkened and soundproof room.
If perhaps at 1:30 in the morning, Alice hears a gentle scratching on her window and sees Bob outside whispering, "It's time."
Obviously, that is not practical if you are the Alice and the Bob you want to communicate with is some store online that you want to do business with. You're not going to go meet up somewhere. You might as well just do the transaction in the physical place.
I sometimes do go up to brick and mortar stores at 1:30 in the morning and just
exchange a secret code.
Whisper into their walls.
It's
just
time.
Like, yes.
And they say, no, it's not.
All secrets will be revealed.
All right. So getting away from the creepy and into the actual, how does this work?
But anyway, so ideally you would have a private key. Well, quantum key distribution is a way we have figured out to do exactly that, to share a private key without Eve being able to intercept it.
And it's all because it relies upon the laws of quantum physics, not on just zeros and ones. Zeros and ones come into play because that, again, is the basis for computing. And we haven't created a new model of computing, so we're still reliant upon that. But how do we generate a key that would allow us to encode and decode messages based on zeros and ones, but transmitted in such a way that it is impossible for an eavesdropper to pick up on it? And that's where we get this quantum key distribution. That's really the other way of saying quantum cryptography. A lot of people think of it as quantum encryption, which is not what's going on. There's no quantum element to the encryption, because by the time you've gotten to the point where you actually have a key, all the quantum stuff is over. You're done with the quantum.
Well, I'm sure I've said quantum encryption a ton of times. That's what
everybody
says.
I know I have. That's why I'm specifically addressing it now.
Yeah, but if we've said that in the past, and specifically if I wrote those words in the video, I don't know if I did, but...
Well, even if you didn't, I may have said them.
Okay, well, in any case, what we mean there is quantum key distribution, using these quantum principles to create a private key.
So here's what's going on, because we've danced around it enough, and now I get the... the unenviable task of trying to explain this. So, all right, Alice and Bob. We still have Alice and Bob. Alice wants to send Bob a private message, but first she has to establish this private key between the two of them. And like you said, Joe, you can't just send a private key through classical channels and expect it to get there without someone looking at it.
That's, right. That, always assume Eve's listening.
Right. So how does Alice do this? She ends up setting up two different channels of communication. You have a quantum channel of communication and a classical channel of communication.
So in real life, this quantum channel of communication would probably be some kind of fiber optic transmission or
yes.
a way of transmitting a photon.
Yes. Photons, particles of light. Like we said, the particles of light have this this quality, spin, where they can be spinning vertically, horizontally, or diagonally. So beforehand, Alice and Bob have determined which spins will mean a 1 versus a 0. So you might say, vertical spins, those are 1s. Horizontal spins are 0s. Diagonal spins one way are a 1. Diagonal spins the other way are a 0. So now they know it which one's going to be a 1 or a 0. Then what Alice does is she sets up a photon emitter, an LED, mm-hmm. would be a good one, and then starts to generate photons one by one. Now, when she generates them, they have this superposition where they've got all spins at once. This is unpolarized light. She then puts it through a filter, which polarizes the light, either a vertical, horizontal, or diagonal filter. This gives the photon a specific spin. It eliminates all the other possibilities. She then starts to transmit these photons one by one to Bob, changing filters as she's going to whatever, you know, pattern or random group she wants. Now, Bob is receiving these photons, and he's passing them through filters of his own. His filters come in two flavors. He's got a filter that will allow either vertical or horizontal spin to come through, and he has another filter that will allow diagonal spin to come through, either direction of diagonal spin.
So what happens if the wrong type of polarized photon hit, if a polarized photon hits the opposite type of filter?
If he has a diagonal filter and a either horizontal or vertical spin photon comes,
yeah.
it will not pass through that filter, and he'll get a fail, essentially. It'll say that he does not know what that particular number will be.
Right, but that's okay.
That's fine. In fact, he just keeps on going, and just the random chance, 50% of the time, he's going to end up getting a filter that works properly with this the one that Alice sent. That's just based upon, you know, a long enough string and probability, because he can get half of what is sent and the other half he wouldn't. So over a long enough string, you're going to see 50% success rate.
Okay.
So then at that point, Alice and Bob, through their classical channel, start to go through, and Bob says, all right, here are the filters that I used in order. And then Alice will say yes or no, as in, yes, that's the right kind of filter for you to have used, or no, it is not. And then by that way, they establish which bits made it through. Because again, they've already agreed if a vertical spin is a 1 and a horizontal spin is a 0. So once they have enough information about which ones pass through, they have a string of 1s and 0s. You eliminate all the X's, all the ones where Bob used the wrong filter, and then you should have enough information there to create a key to encrypt things. However, if during this classical communication, Alice starts to say, you know what, Bob? You haven't gotten any right at all, and that's really weird. That's an indication that someone has been snooping, because one of the facets of the quantum world is that by observing, you change the observed.
Right.
Right? So if Eve is trying to intercept this private key between Alice and Bob, Eve is actually changing that photon spin and creating a string of photons that have exactly the right spin to send it on to Bob is not a practical solution. So, in other words, Eve ends up changing the key before it can get to Bob. And because those changes are detectable, Alice and Bob would know if someone's been listening. And if they know that, they know to abandon that key and to start over.
Right. So the safety comes in the awareness of Alice and Bob. It's not that Eve couldn't tap this line.
Right.
It's that Alice and Bob will always, because of the laws of quantum mechanics, be able to tell if
when
Eve has tapped the line.
The line is tapped, right.
And this is just to make that key, right? There's no information that's going across yet.
Right.
Alice hasn't said, hey, Bob, what's for dinner? She hasn't written any kind of message. They're just trying to establish what is the key they're going to use to encode and decode messages. And because once they establish that, they have completely symmetrical keys. They're identical keys. I shouldn't say symmetrical. They're identical. Then they know that they can encode and decode perfectly.
Yeah. And then they can send over classical channels using that private key. I mean, it's
right.
almost as if they had met up and agreed on a key and then went back their separate ways.
Right, because they're establishing a key safely over this classical channel of communication.
And
right.
there's no way to determine what that key was, because in order to know what that key was, you had to have received those photons. But if you receive the photons, you change the photons. So that means that the other recipient, the actual intended recipient, would have caught on to it. And again, they would have abandoned it and started it again. So Eve would eventually either frustrate Alice and Bob to the point where Alice and Bob just like, well, we're just not going to communicate. Or Eve would get frustrated and quit trying to eavesdrop because it wasn't productive. She's
right.
never going to get anything other than the attempts to create a secure private key.
Right. It's pointless on Eve's part.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There's another approach, though, right, which has to do with spooky action at a distance.
No. I hadn't even heard about this one, so I'm intrigued to see what you're going to say.
So, yeah, the other
spooky action is called quantum entanglement.
Right. This is where you can create a pair of quantum particles like photons, and they will have identical features in some way. And when you measure one, you will know exactly what the state is of the other particle at the moment that it was measured.
Right. So they're entangled, and then you can take them to opposite ends of the galaxy, and you look at one, and by looking at that one, you will immediately know something about the other one
right.
at the other end of the galaxy.
Now, from that point on, you can't determine anything, right?
Right.
Because
you've changed the system by looking at it.
Yeah, they're unentangled.
You've wrecked everything.
Yes. Everything you touch, you destroy, which pretty much true in the quantum world. So so the idea I saw, and this was more of a hypothetical, this is not typically how it's more typical that it's done in that filtering system that I just talked about. But hypothetically, you could create a set of entangled photons. I believe you'd have to measure them exactly at the right time to be able to determine what that sequence was, so that Alice and Bob would have identical private keys. Because here's the thing is, if you observe one, then they become unentangled. So let's say Alice goes ahead and observes her string of photons. Bob has not looked at his string of photons. But once Alice does, then they become unentangled. And so whatever Bob says won't match what Alice has anyway. So I'm not sure exactly how the implementation would work, but hypothetically, they have talked about using, they being quantum scientists, talked about using these strings of entangled particles in order to create identical private keys that, again, if an eavesdropper gets hold of one of them, just by looking at them, they become unentangled and they are no longer useful as a private key in the first place. So, fascinating. Don't know what the implementation would be yet. I understand the filtering one more than I understand this one.
Both of them are pretty dense once you get down to the technical level. Sure.
Oh, yeah. No. Once you get down to like, all right, well, why is this happening? You get a lot of, I don't know.
I'm always comforted that quantum physicists themselves usually kind of go like,
yeah, you get to a point where they're like, yeah, okay, I don't know anymore.
Well, they tend to be, they're really smart people. They can describe what's happening really well.
Oh, sure, sure. When you start asking them why, they're like, well, that's a great question.
Like, why not? So, yeah.
Okay, but I wanted to point out something that's really cool about quantum cryptography, which is that this is not some far future pie in the sky fantasy,
no.
is it?
No, the idea was
we
was
have
first,
this system today.
Yeah, the ideas were mentioned back in the 80s. I mean, this idea has been around for like 25 years in some form or another.
It's not used widely.
No. Yeah, because it does have some pretty tough limitations. Obviously, we're talking about these quantum states. They are very delicate. And again, any kind of disturbance of that state is going to have an effect and thus make this private key sharing an impossibility. So yeah, you're limited by how far you can transmit this information without danger of the photons getting, you know, quote unquote, lost along the way. So it's a matter of kilometers, right? It may be a few dozen kilometers, but it's not like coast to coast. You could not have a coast to coast fiber optic cable as of right now and expect that quantum state to be preserved for the entire length of that cable. And so it would be really difficult to share a private key across that way.
Yeah. I also want to introduce some other considerations that we should take into account, because a lot of people are looking at quantum cryptography and they're saying, amazing, it's unhackable. And I actually do agree with them in theory, because of the way it's constructed, based on the laws of quantum physics, it is in theory unhackable. Mm-hmm. The principle is completely sound. The implementation, on the other hand, we don't know. I mean, because that's a problem that's often come up in cryptography before. For example, we've had major security scares on the internet that had nothing to do with the soundness of public key encryption.
Oh, sure. So you're talking specifically about Heartbleed.
Right. So, yeah, looking at the Heartbleed bug, oh, man, everybody had to change their passwords. It was panic. But the problem wasn't that somebody had found a way to decode all of your public key encryption. No, it was a bug.
Well, yeah.
It's a design flaw.
It was a vulnerability in OpenSSL, that's a secure socket layer, which is a type of security measure that's in place over a great deal of internet websites, like tons of them.
On many, many servers. Not all, but
yeah, something like 60% that were using that form of security were using that specific, specific type. Now, OpenSSL had several versions. You know, it's kind of like any other software where you get generations of the software, you know, 1.0, 1.01, 1.02, that kind of thing, unless you're a Mac and then it's 10.10 for reasons that, never mind, I'm going to go off on a tangent.
Yeah.
So, at any rate, the problem in certain versions of OpenSSL was in something that they called a heartbeat. And the purpose of the heartbeat was really just to say, hey, are you still there?
And the other server says, yeah.
And then everything's fine. Except instead of just saying, hey, are you still there? And the server says, yeah, the server responds with whatever the original message was going to be.
Right. It's sort of like asking, hey, Jonathan, if you're still there, say yes.
And then I would say yes. But
if instead a tricksy person gets in there and says, hey, Jonathan, I'm totes the server. Are you still there? If so, say yes, but say it in 98 characters.
Yeah. So in this case, what was going on was that the message going out to the server was short. The actual message was short, but the metadata about the message said it was much longer. So in other words, if I send out a request to a server and say, hit me back to let me know you're still there. This is the message, and the message is only 3 characters long, but it says it's 500 characters long. Then the server's going to say, all right, I'm still here. Here's your message. But then it says, wait a minute. The number of characters I put in here is 497 short of what it should be. Oh, I'll just fill it up with whatever random stuff happens to be in my memory to pad it out. It's kind of like, it's kind of like cheating, right? You're like, ooh, they expect to have a thick envelope back. I'm just going to shove a whole bunch of blank pieces of paper or random things.
And so sometimes those random things would be people's passwords.
Yeah, or private keys.
Or private keys, so, or lots of other wacky information.
Yeah, so if you targeted a server that, for instance, handled email exchanges, and you got a bunch of random information from the server's memory. Some of that random information could be private keys that would allow you to decrypt things as if you were that person, right? It's not like you were using a hack. You were just using that person's key. It's like you had found a key and made a copy of it yourself, and you're using that key to get in and out of that person's house. Same sort of thing. So, you could do it completely undetectable by anybody else. And people began to panic by changing their passwords, but the problem was changing your password doesn't solve that problem. You would have to have the on the server side, you would have to have administrators patch the server OpenSSL approach to
a version that did not contain that
that bug.
That flaw.
Exactly.
And then change your password.
Yes. It was only after it had been patched that changing your password would matter at all.
Right. So the analogy of all this to quantum cryptography is that even though the principle might be completely sound, you can always have something like the Heartbleed bug.
Well,
you
yeah.
can always have a problem with the specific way you designed this system. It might be a hardware problem. Maybe the way you're using, the way you're emitting photons or something is vulnerable to detection.
Here's an easy way. Here's an easy way that would totally ruin it. So, you know, we talk about Alice and Bob and we're talking about them comparing filters. All of that would obviously be automated. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't actually have two people physically putting filters in place and physically checking that system. So,
oh, I think I see where you're going. Are you talking about if you could control the filters they use?
Or you don't have to control the filters they use. Because even that would be a little weird. But what you could do is if you were not careful in the way you designed the software, you could have it where Alice and Bob are exchanging, in order to confirm that the message has gone over, exchanging too much information revealing what that string of numbers actually is.
Mm.
You know, the idea is that you're sharing information about the process, but not about the actual zeros and ones.
Right.
Right. You're kind of talking around the problem so that you can both figure out which ones and which zeros came through without actually saying, oh, it's 1001. What? Because that would be useless. You would essentially be doing the same thing as sending the private key. But it could easily be where someone creates this sort of approach and has an implementation that reveals too much about the actual key and gives people enough of a hint to make it useless.
Yeah, I've seen some people say also that the security of the process in the long term will depend on our ability to create truly random numbers.
Sure.
And so if you have a number that's supposed to be random but is actually not random.
Huh. Oh, right, because folks, random number generators usually are not actually random.
No, they're random-ish.
Yeah, they're so complexly derived that they seem random to us.
Right. Because, I mean, it's hard to program a computer to say, make up a number without telling the computer, how does it make up a number? It usually has to pull information from something. There's some really cool examples of doing that by using things like environmental factors. Like, well, the barometric pressure is such and the wind direction is such. And so those things are going to mean that I multiply these two numbers together to get your random number, which is kind of cool because it's based on a chaotic system, but still not
it's
truly
still an
random.
Algorithm and not actually. Right.
Yeah. I want to introduce another concern on top of that, which is that so there may be design flaws, but we'll trust that, okay, the people designing these systems are probably very, very smart and they're taking a lot of precautions. And let's say they do design a foolproof system.
Okay.
You know what they can't do? They can't design foolproof users.
Yeah. Now, this is always going to be a problem. So one of the things that we see over and over again is that a lot of systems that are supposedly secure end up becoming vulnerable, not because of some inherent flaw or because a hacker was able to crunch numbers enough times to get into a system, or that someone has created a weird program where you type in three guesses on a password and the third one's always right in Hollywood.
But rather because, you know, that guy from Seinfeld has created a back door that's going to let all of the dinosaurs eventually run amok on the island.
Kind of, yeah. more like the idea of, hey, I wonder what Lauren's password is. Let me pick up this keyboard. Oh, sure enough, there's a post-it note with a password on it.
Or a much easier one, say, if you're not in the same office, is I send Jonathan an email saying, hey, I'm the new assistant to your system administrator, and I need your password in order to do some maintenance on your computer.
Yeah, this is called social engineering. It's manipulating the people in a system rather than the technology. And often, it ends up being the most effective way of getting access to any secure system. If you read any reports about some of the famous hackers, a lot of their exploits involve, not to use a pun, a lot of their exploits involve manipulating people, not sitting down at a computer and typing in zeros and ones until things magically happen.
Right. Well, typically the people are the weakest part of the whole process.
Yeah, that's why I anticipate wiping them all out and making a perfect clean future where I don't have to worry about these weaknesses.
Where dinosaurs rule the earth.
All right. Well, this got dark fast, guys.
All right. So, no, obviously I'm not going to wipe out people.
Jonathan loves people.
Who's going to carry all my stuff?
What would you eat without people?
It'd be really lonely going to the same restaurants over and over again all by myself, and robot waiters saying table for one again. Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, I probably won't do that. No, it's, I'm putting it on the back burner. But anyway, yeah, it's true. Any system, any secure system, you need to look at the people as well as the technology and make sure the people know the best practices for remaining secure and private so that other people who want to get access to that stuff don't have as easy a time about it. The harder we make it, the less likely it'll happen. It doesn't mean that someone who's really determined won't find a way. Now, the quantum cryptography approach is really darn secure because that's basic laws of physics that, as far as we know, are unbreakable.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can get the physical systems to take advantage of those laws of quantum physics, we got it made. But we already are seeing limitations right now, and it's, you know, there's still questions about whether or not this could ever be a widely implemented security feature. You know, it might be something that we see in something like a military installation where the different machines on that installation use quantum cryptography to communicate with each other. But if I'm sending an email to a buddy of mine who lives out in California, there may not be a physical system that can take advantage of this, but just because of the very nature of the quantum world. So they're, you know, things to think about. But I really think this was an interesting topic. It's great to kind of explore it, especially since we always love looking at the quantum world and marveling at how unusual it is.
Yeah.
You know, how alien it is to us on the macro level. So we love those kind of topics. And this is where I invite you, our listener, if you have any interesting topics that are future-oriented, whether it is a technology you want to know about or some development in science or some big question about what is culture and society going to be like in 150 years or even, hey, there's this other thing that science fiction films never address and I really want to know about it, you should let us know. Send us a message. You can contact us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. We have the handle FWThinking at all three. And we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.